You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Daniel Lee on the show with me today. He has an amazing new book that everyone needs to have on their bookshelf. It's called The SS Officer's Armchair, Uncovering the Hidden Life of a Nazi. I love this book so much, Daniel. I have enjoyed reading it and really just taking my time and kind of pouring over it. It's one of my favorite books that's come out this year. Welcome to the
show.
You're
too kind. Thank you very much. What a lovely introduction. Very kind.
Absolutely. Daniel, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Gosh, that is a tough one. I suppose, thinking back as a kid, I used to really love reading detective books. When I was probably in my early teens, I used to sort of devour, work my way through everything by Agatha Christie. And I used to just love the way she used to describe scenes and rooms and scents and everything like that. And I think that her sort of, you know, characters of like Hercule Poirot, Miss Marple, I suppose that's what really got me into thinking about writing and what it means to be a good and thoughtful writer.
I Agatha Christie has been a gateway drug for a lot of writers. It seems like, there's a reason why those books still resonate so deeply with people today. And, I've talked about it a couple of times when they remade the movie of Murder on the Orient Express. What a well-crafted story. You know, I watched that with my kids and just relived all of those early Agatha Christie memories that I had. It's so fantastic.
Right. And then we get into the whole debate about who is the best Poirot, but that's perhaps for another show.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Daniel, when you, from those early Agatha Christie memories, did you pursue writing? Was that something that you knew from then on that was going to be a life pursuit and you worked toward that? Or, are you like a lot of writers that, you know, a good bit of life happened in the midst and then writing reared its head back? How did that unfold for you?
Yeah, I totally never, ever thought I would be a writer. I'm not even sure today if I still am, even though I've written two books. I feel that writing is the hardest thing I ever have to do. In my life, it's something that doesn't come easily. It's something which, you know, I sit around sometimes and really think about these sentences and paragraphs, etc., and the way and shape that they're going to follow. So it's definitely something which doesn't come, you know, you meet some writers and they can sort of, you know, write a book before lunch and, you know, you just want to kill yourself. But no, with me, that hasn't always been my case. You know, I'm much more, you know, I'm a historian by training. I'm interested in the way we think about history and research and try and like follow various trails in terms of uncovering the past and putting bits of history back together and asking new questions. So the writing is something which I love to do, but it's something which it usually comes after having done a lot of research first. When I'm really ready to write, I will start to write.
Daniel, what is it about the past that intrigues you so much?
I think I've always been intrigued about the past, always. Even as a kid, like going to museums and galleries and stuff like that. It's just a way of, well, even back to Agatha Christie, there's a way of just sort of escaping into these moments, complicated moments, you know, where we think we often think that the past, we can learn from it because things were so clear, or we can understand today because, you know, there are all these messages from the past. But when we actually start looking and digging deeper, we think, gosh, you know, the past was an extremely complicated, ambiguous time. And it's only often with hindsight that we start to, you know, have this quite romantic image of the past. So I think that's what I love doing with my history. And that's what I do with my students, especially. You know, we really try and unravel some of these beliefs and images and ideas we think are so true of the past, and really start asking and probing new questions of them. And it's amazing how quickly things start to untangle.
Right. Daniel, there have been quite a few books dealing with, you know, the early mid 20th century, World War II specifically, that have come out in the last couple of years. And there seems to really be a fire in the belly of the reading world that we can't get enough of this time period right now. You know, World War II has always been a fascinating subject, but there just seems to be there's something about this time that's really resonating with people right now. What is it about this time period, these interesting, you know, world happenings that have us intrigued so much?
Right. I mean, it's a great question. I mean, the end of the war was such a long time ago, yes, three quarters of a century ago, and yet we are still asking so many questions of the past, and there's still so much good history that remains to be written. It's not one of these episodes where we can sort of neatly tie up and move on. Just from the basics in terms of like archives and access to documents, so many things were either lost or were held in depositories for decades, and only now a lot of historians are finding that they can have access to and can shed new light on some of these bigger questions that we thought we'd solved a long time ago. In terms of other things, you know, how we deal about, you know, the, like you say, the mid-century, how we think about, you know, communism, totalitarianism, fascism, etc., these big questions about what it meant to live under an authoritarian regime, how it was that ordinary people got caught up with things. You know, that's something that's, I think, so fascinating to a lot of humans. You know, what would I have done if I had been in Stalin's Russia or in, you know, Hitler's Germany? How would I have acted? What would I have done to my neighbors? And I think people are often, you know, trying to look back to their past, to these pasts, these complicated pasts, to try and like shed some kind of understanding onto today's situations.
Noveler is the best way to write a novel. Why? Quite simply because we've made it the easiest place to do it. Writing a novel is hard enough. Noveler takes care of all the logistical bits of writing a novel, just leaving that small matter of the words to you. It's a clean, beautiful writing interface with writing analytics, goals and streaks, advanced grammar checking, version control, day, evening, and night modes, and many other features designed to take all the stress out of writing. Tell us what you need and we'll build it. Together, we'll build a better tool. With a design-led approach, all the right tools that you need, Noveler saves all your words constantly, allows you to manage and order your novel easily. It's accessible from any device, desktop or mobile. It syncs to Google Drive and Dropbox. It allows exports in various formats, including ebook and more. It also has nice touches like allowing you to write both offline and online, unique for a web-based platform. Everyone needs help with their writing, from inspiration through to grammar checking, so we're doing our best to provide that support. We integrate that support directly into Noveler. Our advanced grammar checker powered by Pro Writing Aid does everything from spell check to style advice. Our writing courses include the incredible Tim Clare's Couch to ADK. We're really excited to offer all Author Stories listeners 30% off Noveler for a whole year. And it doesn't matter if you choose to sign up for the monthly or annual plan, you'll get 30% off. All you need to do is use the discount code Hank when you sign up. Noveler, Novlr. That's noveler.org. Well, that is a fascinating point, because there's so much about these world changing events that we, because we are so removed and we live such a comfortable, cushy life in most cases, that it's easy for us to say, oh, I would have done this, I would have done that, while not having to actually pay the price for doing that. It's very easy for me in America in the 21st century to say, I would never do that. I would never be a part of this or that. You know, but if the circumstances were a little different and, you know, I was protecting my family or I was having to provide for them, we never know the small sacrifices that we make, or the small, what's the word I'm looking for? Where we the compromises we make, that then we look back and go, oh my God, how did I get here? Well, it was the little compromises day by day that got you there.
And people were very complicated.
Yes.
People acted in so many different ways. This is something I talk about in my first book, which is about being young and Jewish in Nazi-occupied France. And some of the stuff I discovered, my gosh, I was thinking to myself, how could people react like this? You know, the Nazis around the corner, and yet Jewish people are doing certain, joining certain societies or joining certain groups, which made me think, you know, why go to hiding? Don't start to do this or that. So it was a deeply complicated time. But I think that at the time, we just got to remember that a lot of decisions that people made, they made sense to those people back then. And only now, with hindsight, do a lot of decisions really seem contradictory or totally crazy. And it's like you say, it's completely impossible most of the time to even get anywhere near close to putting ourselves in the shoes of some of these actors.
Sure, sure. I have grown up in the American South, and we have a very complicated history over the last, you know, 200 years or so. A lot of those things are coming to light now and in our current, situations. And many of us now, from our 21st century vantage point, you know, are very comfortable, and don't have to deal with a lot of these questions. I have a friend who is German, who now lives in the United States, but he grew up in Germany, and I've had some of these questions for him. You know, what did the people older than you who lived through this time period, you know, did they talk about it much when you were growing up? And he said, no one ever said anything about any of that time. And it was just not a topic of conversation. In your digging, in research that you have done, how do you feel like the present Germans feel about their history?
Your anecdote, Hank, it reminded me of I think it was a Simpsons episode I saw probably about 20 years ago, where I think the family, for some reason, the Simpson family end up going on a tour or something in somewhere in Germany. I can't remember. And I think, like, somebody asks the question, probably Lisa, you know, sorry, the guidebook doesn't really have anything on the 1930s and 40s. What happened here during those years? And the tour guide was like, oh, no, nothing happened. Tour over. Move on. Quickly like that. I think post-war Germany must have been an extremely bizarre place in the 50s and 60s. You had these... You know, it was just a land of silences. It was a land where people couldn't ask their parents what they'd done in the war. Conversations were closed. People found these remarkable ways of changing the subject, or telling people, oh no, don't ask daddy that, he'll get too upset, or whatever. So, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm exaggerating, but there was almost a whole generation of Germans who couldn't speak to their parents for many, many years about what they had done during the 1930s and 40s. And some refused ever to speak about it.
Well, you know, that's it's easy to think when you look in your past that that was the Nazi party that was responsible for all this happening. I am an average citizen. I had nothing to do with this. This was not my choosing. We were basically taken over from within by, you know, a dictator who did this. Your new book, The SS Officer's Armchair, peels back some of the layers of that way of thinking and gives us a glimpse at the life of kind of an ordinary, Nazi party official, kind of, low ranking.
Exactly. Right.
And that's what I found so fascinating about this book, because there's all kinds of stories about the people in charge, the strategist, and these types of people, but there's very little told about the everyday goings on about this. How did this story come into your life?
So the guy, this is a micro history. So this is a story about one guy who, like you say, was not Hitler or Himmler or some of these big names that everybody knows about. He was just one, what I would call an ordinary Nazi, of whom we know, of which we know very, very little, because despite the hundreds and thousands of books being produced every year about the Second World War and the Nazis, most of these books still deal with the guys at the top, these very famous people who were part of Hitler's cabinet. And very, very little ink has been spilt on the guys much lower down the chain, the guys who were actually filling in the forms, doing the paperwork that were resulting in so many of the atrocities being carried out. So my ambition was, I was always interested in these very low-ranking people in France, and in Germany. And the story, in a way, it fell into my lap because I had recently finished my PhD in England and I'd moved to Italy. And I, just as I was settling in, I was organizing an event at my place. I just met a few people. I was like, come over for dinner. And there was one woman there and she just said to me straight away, you know what? You're a historian of the Second World War. I think you can help me with something. And I was intrigued. I said, well, what is that? And she said, well, my mother, she has this very old armchair, which she's had for like 30, 40 years. She's carried it with her whole life. And she just took it to get reupholstered because it was so filthy. And when she went to collect it in Amsterdam, because this woman was Dutch, she said the guy doing the work presented her with these bundle of documents covered in Nazi swastikas. And the woman just stood there in the guy's shop and was like, well, I have no idea who this is, because all the documents belong to one guy called Robert Kriesinger from Stuttgart in Germany. And the guy in the shop was obviously thinking, this is your dad. I don't do work for Nazis. What is this? How dare you bring this to my shop, etc. And the woman was completely, confused. Had no idea how these documents ended up inside her armchair in her bedroom. And so she just, the daughter came to me and said, please can you figure out for me who is this Dr. Kriesinger and how on earth did his documents end up inside this chair that my mother has had since the 60s? And so that's how the story really starts. I was brought in to figure out as much as I could about this man, his chair, and his past. And that's my starting point.
Want to grow as a writer and take your writing to the next level? Give Pro Writing Aid a try. Pro Writing Aid is a grammar checker, style editor, and writing mentor in one package. Pro Writing Aid will never replace a human editor. Rather, it helps you self-edit to a deeper level so that when you send it off to an editor, they will be able to focus on the meat of your writing and not spend their time fixing basic writing issues. Pro Writing Aid is the only platform that offers world-class grammar and style checking, combined with more in-depth reports to help you strengthen your writing. Our unique combination of suggestions, articles, videos, and quizzes makes writing fun and interactive. Writing can be grammatically perfect, but still feel awkward and clumsy. Pro Writing Aid searches out elements like repetitiveness, vague wording, sentence length variation, over-dependence on adverbs, passive voice, over-complicated sentence structures, and so much more. Nothing makes a writer lose credibility faster than spelling and grammar mistakes. Submit clean, error-free writing. Go to ProWritingAid.com and use code HANK20 for 20% off of Pro Writing Aid Premium. Pro Writing Aid. Check it out today. That had to be a very uncomfortable conversation to have with the furniture upholsterer, I can imagine.
It's interesting. It must have been. But, you know, as the as my research went on, you know, the first thing I do is I go to Prague, because I realized that this woman had purchased the chair in Prague in the 1960s. She was a student, and she needed just some basic furniture, like all of us, for our student apartments or whatever. So she just, like, went to a thrift store, bought like a bed, bought a chair, etc., took it home. And then in the 1980s, when she left communist Czechoslovakia, she was able to take a couple of objects with her, including this chair. So that's why I knew that this chair had this history. It had nothing to do with the Netherlands or Amsterdam. The history of this chair was in Prague. So I went to Prague with about 30 photographs of this chair. I was just walking in and out of chair manufacturers and upholsterers and furniture dealers, just trying to find out anything I could about this chair, like who made it, how much did it cost, who was its intended buyer, things like this. And what was amazing was the reactions of the chair people were completely different to the one, the guy in Amsterdam, who was so, like you say, so cross and so upset with his client. In Prague, on the contrary, these people were like, when I told them that Nazi documents had been discovered inside this chair, they didn't bat an eyelid. One guy took a puff on his cigarette and just looked at me and said, "Excuse me, sir, this was communist Czechoslovakia, for God's sake. I find stuff hidden in chairs and mattresses every single day. This is no big deal." So it really does depend on context as well.
It does. It does. One thing that I love about your book is the way that it's written. I'm a big fan of narrative nonfiction, and there's a certain style that people write nonfiction, but it reads like a novel, and I really love a lot of those types of books. But this one has a different style. It's more of a it's your story of uncovering this story, which I find fascinating. At what point in digging for the truth of this finding did you realize there was a book there?
Well, I knew I wanted to write the book at the beginning, just because as soon as I met this woman and she told me about what happened to her mother, I thought, gosh, this is it. This is, you know, the story I've been waiting for. For such a long time, because, like I said, I've always been interested by the little guys and the ones who we know nothing about, yet who after the war were able to go back to their lives and whose names had just totally disappeared from the historical record. So as soon as I had the name of one of these guys, I always knew, right, that's it. This is my time. But just in terms of finding stuff about him, it was just so hard. Like, you can't look anything. There's nothing on, you know, I type his name into Google. Like, I look in some history books. These ordinary guys who were working in all of these offices, it was just so hard to find stuff out about them. So, you know, it involved a lot of archival digging, going to, like I said, to Prague to find out what he had done in Prague. I discovered he was in the SS, thanks to being in the archives in Prague, and that sent me on a journey to Berlin to look at the SS archives in Berlin, which eventually was able to tell me much more about his social life, his family life, his personal life during the Third Reich. But eventually it was just, there was just so much frustration. The archives could never tell the whole story, and I just was really wanting to talk to people who might have known him or remembered him, who could shed any light. But just locating anybody was just impossible. And so one day I just picked up the phone book, the telephone directory, to Stuttgart and just phoned every single person whose name had the last name as him. And of course, everybody hung up at first, thought I was crazy or was selling something. But eventually somebody said, "Oh, yes, that was my, I know that name. That's my father's brother. How can I help you?" And, you know, it was totally mad. You know, I didn't even know what to say. I never actually thought anybody would know him. So it was just, I didn't know what to say. "Oh, excuse me, I found your father's brother's documents hidden in an armchair in Amsterdam." He would have thought I was crazy. So I just made up a ridiculous story about, "Oh, I'm doing some work on lawyers in the Third Reich, because Giesinger was a lawyer. Do you think I could come and talk to you?" So that's how I was able to make contact with his family, just by going through the phone book and eventually striking lucky by finding a relative.
Did finding that relative, did that make you, did that give you a personal connection to, because, you know, before then it was kind of all academic, wasn't it? You know, was this a real person? You know, who knows? Well, finding a relative, that's a different kind of discovery, isn't it?
You're absolutely correct. You've really hit the nail on the head with that. Because, yeah, all of these people that we, as historians, we look at, they're all completely vague objects in history. They have sometimes very little texture. They're just, in a way, they are object of study. Whereas when you actually talk to a relative, these people actually, you know, they knew them, or they knew of them, or they'd heard tales or whatever. They can just bring this entirely new dimension, because to these people, this person was an uncle, a father, a relative. It wasn't just some kind of abstract object that we as historians obsess about. So that created this very peculiar dynamic where, you know, I would be sitting with the family members with, at the one hand, I had my historian's hat on, but at the same time, these people, they wanted to know a lot from me about what I had discovered. So it was a very curious relationship that came up over the course of these years during our interviews that, you know, we were both quite reliant on each other. You know, I would want to know information from them, but they also wanted to know what I was discovering about their relative.
Did that change the your attitudes about this man when there was something to anchor his humanity on? Did that change the way you thought about him?
No, because unfortunately, despite hearing personal stories about him being such a, you know, wonderful father who was devoted to his family, who cared so much for animals, etc., that doesn't in any way take away from the despicable things he was doing during his time at the SS or the Gestapo. Obviously, it paints him in a new light for me, and it was fascinating to know a bit more, because, you know, we think of these SS officers and these Gestapo agents as, you know, these monsters in their black coats who go around, you know, shooting communists and Jews every single day. So having this other side to them, this more family, this more personal side, was extraordinary. I mean, at one point I was in his nephew's house, and this is the family house since, I don't know, like the last 100 years or something. Nothing's ever been removed from that house. And I was able to, his nephew just opened a drawer one day and found Griesinger's mother's diary. So he just sort of started flicking through it. And it turned out that Griesinger's mother had kept a diary from the day her son was born until the day he went to university when he was sort of 19. So I got this amazing insight into this young Nazi's life. His mother was writing every single day in her journal about her son, you know, just trying all sorts of information. I mean, basic information, you know, how old he was when he took his first steps and lost his first tooth. But then other things about his, you know, interest in politics and how he, like so many of these Nazis who successful Nazis who were born, but between 1900 and 1910, they made up this extraordinary generation, which we as historians call the war youth generation. They were far too young to fight in the First World War, so they totally missed out on that. But boy, did the defeat of 1918 come to impact the rest of their lives. Like, what happened to these men and women in 1918, 1920, the total humiliation, the defeat by the Allies, and the total collapse of every single thing they knew, devastated this generation, and it just led to complete disorder. It led towards huge feelings of, I suppose, a lot of people, that's where the anti-communism originally came from, and of course anti-Semitism. So it was just having access to his mother's diary just was able to, was an extraordinary tool for me to get into his head, this young man's head, and to see the direction that he was going.
When you start studying people and human behavior, one of the discussions or arguments that inevitably comes up is the idea of nature versus nurture. Is there actual evil in the world? Are people trained to have evil thoughts, intentions, actions? You know, are certain behaviors picked up along the way? Are you born that way? You know, there's lots of discussions around that. When you're discovering this person and then by extension, you know, by studying this person, you're getting to see how a lot of people learned and behaved, because this is a normal everyday person. Did it change or challenge what you thought about human nature and behavior, or did this help to solidify thoughts that you already had about how easily we can be drawn astray, or I'm not sure exactly the words I'm looking for, but how did this make you feel about, you know, the how susceptible any of us are into being led gradually astray?
Right. No, I think it takes, you know, a huge exception, some of these amazing forces, to make individuals speak out and to do things which your neighbor isn't doing, or to do things which might seem a little different. I mean, it's just amazing, those people who are able to do that at a given historical moment. And I think some of those people, we see that today. Some people today are finding their voices to speak out and not just bury their head in the sands. And I just think that's utterly remarkable. But, you know, if anything, you know, when I look at, for example, looking at Nazi-occupied France, where I think of, you know, the number of people who were in the resistance, who decided to resist against the Vichy regime or the Nazi occupation. You know, these people were in the utter minority. You know, when you think of the number of people who were either carrying out, carrying explosives or fighting Germans or just delivering tracts, you know, most people just got on with their everyday life and hope that the war would end soon. Yes, they might have been hoping for the Brits and the Americans to win the Allies' victory, but they didn't actually sort of act out in a way that was they weren't showing their resistance on their sleeve. And I think there's a lot to be said about that, you know, in terms of living under a dictatorship too. A lot of these people, like you said earlier, you know, they had, you know, their families to think of. And I just think if we think of people like Huizinga, the absolute enemy for people like him would have been the communists. Like, a communist victory in Germany in the early 30s would have been the end of his world. He came from this very highly educated, middle class, patriotic, Protestant background, and communism, which was on the rise at that time, just threatened to undo absolutely everything. It was this communist menace that he felt, and thousands of others felt, was undermining their way of life. And I think that, so this guy Hitler comes along and the Nazis come along, and, well, okay, maybe Huizinga didn't vote for them and maybe he disapproved of some of their measures, but look what they're doing. They're destroying the communist menace. You know, so, you know, they're taking things out on communists, they're taking things out on social democrats, they're taking things out on Jews. You know, I'm none of those things. My life is not being affected by this. I actually, in some ways, maybe I approve of some of these decisions that are being taken. So I think, like I said, it's so hard to put ourselves in these moments. But I just think that we've just got to keep reminding ourselves of the defeat of the First World War, which is something we often forget, and the total humiliation that came as a result of that defeat, this collapse and this total desire for revenge on behalf of thousands of people. And that's what a lot of them did see in Nazism, this opportunity to rebuild a strong, proud, nationalist Germany that had been totally humiliated by everybody else. And so long as they're not coming after me or my family or my neighbor, then you know what? Perhaps this thing isn't too bad for us.
You know, I think one of the things that scares us so much is that because the human race really is a family that has, you know, just exploded over, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years. But I think one thing that scares us is that if we look back far enough, we are likely connected to lots of people that we maybe not be comfortable with, especially looking from our 21st century lens back on history. And that scares a lot of us. You have a connection, your family with this family, that you uncovered, didn't you?
What kind of connection?
Was there a family connection with your family and with his family?
It was remarkable. It was, so Griesinger was part of the German army, which was invading the Soviet Union. By this massive surprise in June 1941, when 3 million Germans suddenly marched east. And, you know, I was investigating his life, I was investigating where he'd come from, etc. And I wanted to trace his every movement. And so I would sort of plot his route into the Soviet Union, and using like a little map and like pins to indicate the route he took, because I saw he was going east towards Ukraine, towards Kiev. Now, I knew that my grandmother's family had come from Ukraine to Britain at the beginning of the 20th century, when so many Jewish families took that migratory route, either to Britain or west or the United States. And, you know, I never, you know, other people, as a historian, other people's family is always so much more interesting. So I never really bothered to ask anything about my family or where we might have come from or anything like that. So it was only when I sort of saw Griesinger going east into Ukraine, and, you know, we all know about some of the violence that the Wehrmacht and the unleashed against the local Jewish population during that campaign, that I suddenly thought, oh, gosh, I wonder if my family was anywhere nearby. But anyway, long story short, I found out from my grandmother the details of the shtetl, the village that her father had come from. And just by plotting his route, I was able to see that Griesinger actually marched through my family's ancestral shtetl in July 1941. You know, and so many relatives didn't take the same choices as my family. So many decided to stay behind in Ukraine. And just the very idea that he had, you know, looked out on the same landscape, seen the same way of life that generations of my family had experienced in this tiny, you know, Ukraine is the largest country in Europe. And out of every single village in that country, he had to go through the one that my family came from. So that was quite, you know, quite chilling, actually, when this sort of me following his trajectory had actually brought me closer to my own family's history.
And that's one of the dangers of looking at history and thinking, this could never have any impact on my life. This happened over there. This happened to those people. The more you study history, the more that we should all be shocked at just how approachable these things are and how these things can affect our lives.
Right. And I think that's very telling when we actually start to retrace Griesinger's history, because we think we know everything about the Nazis, but really, I hate to say it, we are still only scratching the surface as historians. There is so much more we need to know. Like, we have this idea that all Germans during the Third Reich were these, you know, their ancestors had toiled on the German land for generations. No member of the family had ever set foot out of Germany. But this is total nonsense when we start to look at somebody like Griesinger, just by looking at his family tree. You know, his mother, yes, she was born in Germany. But when I start to look at his father's side, we get a completely different story. His father, I've discovered from the SS archives in Berlin, his father was born in New Orleans, Louisiana, in 1871. And his family came to Louisiana in the 1720s. So this is, you know, we were able to go all the way back to a totally different historical environment just by following one person. What I found incredible just by looking at his family when I went to New Orleans and started looking at the archives there were the number of his relatives, his ancestors, who actually owned enslaved people on their plantations throughout Louisiana. This is something that I was totally struck by, that he actually had so many people in his family who had had these this experience of racist thinking, racist interactions. And it was very, you know, a lot of these people, you know, we forget that so many people from the United States did move to Europe at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. We often think that, you know, Europeans would go to America, part of the Great Migration, and that was the end of that. But no, we know that something like a third of European settlers to America actually went back to Europe for various reasons, including Griesinger's father. And a lot of what I'm writing about in this book, like a lot of the ideas from the American South, is something that, you know, they took with them. And that's not just to do with racism, obviously. This is to do with something as basic as me showing up at his front door, the house in Stuttgart, and discovering four enormous columns, pillars at the entrance to the house. You know, this, and when I look at the blueprints to his house, I see that this is modeled on a Louisiana plantation. And obviously, it's the only house in Stuttgart that has these enormous columns as you enter. And also in terms of furniture, so much of the furniture from this house, which has, you know, remained the same since the 1920s, so much of it has this sort of antebellum feel about it. There was a real influence on this family from their Southern heritage.
This book, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but I can say that in reading this book, it really challenged my views of the kind of the innocent small person in these global happenings, and it really made me think about, you know, the small piece that we all play in the grand scheme of things. Did writing this book and doing the research challenge your views on were the small people, the little people, the cogs in the greater machine? Do we have this misguided view of the innocent little person in the grand scheme of things?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think from someone like Griesinger, for people who after the war were able to sort of fit into this very easy narrative that, you know, when we think of how many people were tried at Nuremberg or in the subsequent trials in the late 1940s, you know, we're talking about, you know, a drop in the ocean, several thousand of people compared to, you know, I think there was something like 8 million members of the Nazi Party in 1945, you know, and it was only a few of them, a teeny tiny proportion actually got punished. But for most people, there was very little punishment. It was, you know, the bad guys at the top, they're the ones who had brought us down this road. But for most people just got on, buried their head in the sand, or didn't speak out, or secretly resisted, or whatever. But I think just by following this story of one individual, that it shows that narrative is completely false and made up. People like Griesinger knew exactly what was going on every single day. Just if we follow what he was doing at the SS, if we follow his job at the Gestapo. Yes, he was a lawyer. Yes, he was probably at a typewriter or in an office. But, you know, he was doing his work with the torture cells beneath him. His job in Prague involved sending thousands of ordinary Czech workers to do work in Germany and do forced labor. You know, people like this, would have been extremely easy for them after the war to just, you know, blame their superiors and just say, oh, they didn't know what was going on. But when we actually start delving deeper and we look at these individuals and compare it to the historical record, any sort of claim that they didn't know what they were doing or they were just following orders completely falls apart. You know, a lot of it's always very, very important, I think, as historians to follow these patterns about the people who aren't at the top. Let's start, my advice to students and to anyone whose interest is in, you know, let's start looking at the localities. Let's start looking at the margins. Let's start looking at people whose stories aren't often told. And by goodness, I'm sure you're going to find some surprises.
The book is called The SS Officer's Armchair, Uncovering the Hidden Life of a Nazi. Daniel, like I said, I'm recommending this book to everyone. This is an important book that needs to be in our collective consciousness right now. I put links to it in the show notes of this episode. When you're hearing this episode, the book will actually just went on sale today. Daniel, if people want to dig into more of what you're doing and follow you online, is there a place where they can do that?
Sure. I'm on Twitter, and I am DanielLee550. But of course, if anyone out there has bought the book and is interested in discussing things with me, then just shoot me an email at my university address and I'll try and respond to any questions.
Excellent. I'll include that and your Twitter link in the show notes of this episode as well. Daniel, this has been so much fun talking. I love the book. Like I said, I'm recommending it to everyone. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world settings safe and organized, helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love, and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 800,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too.